Patrick.
Yeah.
Hi. I'm feeling a bit needy today.
Oh,
it's been a funny week.
What do you need, David?
It's been a funny. I just need you to answer a question. I always need you to answer a question. You know that.
It's no different to any other week then.
No,
really.
No, just a bit needier.
All right.
So the question is, when was the last time that you really felt that you belonged?
Felt that I belonged. Yeah. Felt that I belonged.
Do you understand that?
What?
Well, you sounded like you didn't understand the question.
I have social outcast written all over my forehead, do I?
I don't know.
I do, actually. Yeah. I don't. I feel I belong in little bits here and there. And, you know, sometimes you want everything to stay the same in life and it doesn't. Things move and change and you just think, oh, I belong there and I belong there. But actually, everything's always moving. So how... Yeah, I don't know. That's such a big question. I'm not a very clubbable guy. Some people are clubbable. My uncle says they got Velcro and they just instantly attract mates and everything's brilliant and everything's cool. And I sort of have lots of great friends and it's all really nice, but I don't think I've got as much Velcro as everyone else sometimes. There you go.
The Match, because 90 minutes can last a lifetime. Episode 5, 9th of January 1993. Sierra Leone against Togo at the Stade de 28e de Septembre in Conakry in Guinea.
By the time that he played for Sierra Leone, the one and only time that he played, Leroy Rossignol had accomplished plenty. A couple of spells at Fulham, success at West Ham and Queen's Park Rangers, and caps for England at youth level, but never for the senior team. He'd been injured, he'd played injured, and he'd suffered the kind of racist abuse that was sadly present in English football back then. Chants, one-off comments, whole stands sometimes, and players too. Leroy describes this time of his life far better than I could in his book, It's Only Banter. Now, this isn't a podcast which is designed to plug things, certainly things that we don't like, but I'd recommend Leroy's book to you. Honest, open, heartfelt, and one that looks for solutions rather than just talks about problems. I mentioned injury, and it was injuries that finished him as a footballer. Too young, and I know that he'd agree that he never quite achieved what his talent should have let him. One glorious anomaly of Leroy's career is that he played for, once, and managed, twice, Sierra Leone. I've always wondered about that day, an Africa Cup of Nations qualifier against Togo in Guinea. Why did he play? Why did he only play once? And what was it like? And so I asked him, firstly, how he was feeling when his plane touched down in Freetown.
Well, the first thing was the heat hits you as you step out and the light. And then I looked up, and you look at the sky and it's unbelievable, the colour. And then you look down and there's a red carpet. And I'm thinking, oh, there must be someone famous on the plane behind. And I'm looking around just wondering who it is as I come off the plane. And I'm greeted by the sports minister and a stretch limousine. You know, it was absolutely, I was absolutely gobsmacked. And there's people at the airport waiting to greet me. And it was like a return of a superstar. And I didn't realise, you know, I just didn't have an inkling that was the sort of reception I was going to get. So it was absolutely amazing.
So that, I think we need to rewind a bit then. How did it all come about in the first place? When you said you had no inkling, you obviously knew you'd been selected and you're in the squad and you were going to play. Mm-hmm. Had they previously tried to select you and you'd sort of said no, and then this was the time you thought, I've got to do it and I'm going to go? Was that the process?
Yeah, I think they previously tried to get me to go once, and I spoke to my dad and I said, no, don't go, because, you know, there's a it's a difficult place to go. And I think at the time when they'd asked me before, I'd played for England under 21s, and I thought, oh, is there a chance I could play for England? But this time when they asked, I said to my dad, look, I've got to go. You know, I've got to go. They've asked me. Actually, they sent people over, a delegation over to Bristol City to see Dennis Smith, the manager, and to put forward a representation as to why they wanted me to go. And I just felt, look, they've gone to all this trouble, and I think it was my duty to go. So, and I just didn't want to miss out on the experience, and I'm delighted that I didn't miss out on it. So, you know, when that stretch limousine took me through Sierra Leone, takes you across a ferry, you know, to get to the mainland from Lungi Airport. And the greeting that I got when I got to the hotel was just absolutely amazing. You know, it's because it then transpired that, you know, I spoke to my dad. And he said, yeah, well, yeah, everybody knows, you know, you're the only Sierra Leone who's ever played in the, you know, top level football in England. And I think, well, I didn't realise that. You know, you don't think of yourself in that way. And I was in the papers, you know, a lot of what was going on back in England. And to go into the hotel and to put my bag down, I had to take a massive deep breath. But then within 15 minutes of being sat down on the bed, the door started to knock and people coming saying, oh, thank you for coming. We really appreciate you coming. And they're bringing me, you know, presents and food and just the adulation. But people were really grateful that I'd taken the trouble to get on the plane and come and play a game of football. And I realised that it was the right decision then.
I suppose now as well, I mean, you're fully aware of this because you broadcast now mm-hmm. a lot of shows that will go to Africa and to Sierra Leone. And you're one of the reasons that Premier League players are very famous over there and that we all know about it. But I guess back then, yeah, there were communications, of course. It wasn't the dark ages, but it wasn't like it is now. So you wouldn't have been aware. We all know now that Premier League players are huge superstars in Africa, but maybe back then, not so much.
No, absolutely not. And I always laugh because I always think, all right, back then, you know, obviously they weren't getting as live football over then, so they must have thought I was absolutely amazing from the story. So, yeah, and obviously, you know, when you think about things, you know, they must have thought, you know, I was a superstar, but I never thought of myself in those terms, which is good. And you realise, you know, I'd been to the country before as a young man, and it had a really profound effect on me when I'd been with my family. Always remembered it being a beautiful country, but a very poor country. But to go there and have, without opening my mouth, to have that effect, that positive effect on people was incredible. And so that night, I didn't sleep very much. There was lots of pots of food around the room for me. I actually got all the maids and them up to come and take the food away to eat it. So I didn't sleep very, very well. And they also gave me my kit, it was all white. I had the number 9 shirt on it and the Sierra Leone national badge. And I'd laid that kit out and they said, you know, you put that on in the morning from the hotel. So I put the kit on in the morning and came out of the hotel. The coach was waiting outside me with all the rest of the players on. And I remember getting on that coach and just saying hello to the players who I'd met for the first time. The game was going to be played. It's the first time I'd met these players. And we made our way to the hoverport. And there was this, like, a hovercraft waiting for us. And we all got on and I sat by the window and I just gazed out to the ocean, which was absolutely stunning, absolutely stunning. And then the noise of this hovercraft just kind of erupted and off we went. And as we were going towards Guinea, I saw people in rowboats and all sorts of vessels, you know, just making their way across. And I said to the player next to me, I said, what's that? He said, oh, these are people, the supporters going to the game. And I said, well, how long does it take us on the hovercraft? He said, oh, a couple of hours. I said, how long would it take them? He said, oh, half a day, you know, but they're desperate to go to the game. So, you know, it wasn't like, you know, you're going up the M4 or the M1 or the M6. These people are, you know, in rowboats getting to the game. And as we arrived at Guinea, you got off the hovercraft, got on the coach, and we just saw the streets just lined with people, lined with black faces and smiling faces, and just drove straight to the ground. You know, it wasn't like pre-match meal. You know, we drove straight to the ground, and as we got to the ground, to then drive in and go and drive around the running track and to see a ground, it must have been 30,000 people there, just full of black faces, had the most profound effect on me, because that was the first time I played in front of a crowd which would be dominated by black faces. And I thought at that moment to the time when I was a kid and played at Leeds United and you know, a whole stand of white faces were doing the Nazi salute towards me when I was, you know, 17, 18 years old, and how frightened I was. And I felt really comfortable, you know, going. And it's not something you think of. I never felt, you know, I'd never gone and played a game in England thinking, oh, this is really uncomfortable. It would become the norm. But then to see all those black faces had a really profound effect on me. We then got off the coach. And we were there 2 hours before the game. And as I used to describe it not a witch doctor, but someone of that ilk. He was very tall, all dressed in some sort of national dress or such. And he started to bless us, all the players. You're going to do well. You're going to do brilliant. Rosin, you're going to score goals. You're going to be fantastic. This went on for like 45 minutes, you know, and blessing the whole team. And so then all of a sudden that finishes, and then we're on the game. We're starting to warm up to start the game. I remember the pitch not being great. I remember the running track, you know, around the pitch. And then the game kicks off. It wasn't don't think it was the greatest of games, but I think in the first half, the ball came across and I headed it, hit the crossbar. And so we got to half time and I'm thinking, right, where's the coach? But loads of reporters came running on the pitch and surrounded me, wanted to know what I thought of the first half and wanted to have an interview at half time. I think, well, this is ridiculous, you know. So, you know, it was a surreal experience. And then I got with the team. I think we had a quick chat. Didn't really understand what they wanted me to do. in all honesty, but I just got on. We played the game. I don't remember a lot about the game at all. It was 0-0. There was a car waiting for me after the game. I picked up my luggage, got changed out of my kit. I never saw my kit again. And I got a car to the airport. And I just sat there just thinking, wow, that was the most unbelievable 48 hours of my professional career. When I got to the airport in Guinea, put my luggage on, and then the guy said, no, you haven't got the right visa. And all of a sudden, the stretch limousine had disappeared. All the people I'd bypassed, you know, the passport control when I came in. It wasn't the case when I was leaving. I had to pay $100 to get the right visa, funnily enough. Got on the plane, and Bristol City wanted me to play. I think we played on a Wednesday, and I was coming back that Wednesday. I arrived back kind of early Thursday morning. When I arrived back, I remember waiting for my luggage at the other end. My luggage had disappeared as well. So I came back with $100 less, no luggage, but with a big smile on my face because it was a wonderful experience. Got my luggage back 3 months later. I played for Bristol City at the weekend, and it's one of the best experiences of my life.
Before we go back a little bit to the game and the other players and so on, it must have been surreal to be... We all have that feeling when we travel, don't we? You sort of get back to work and you think, oh my God, I was in wherever. I was in Miami yesterday. What's going on? Mm. But that's even stranger. You're kicking off at Ashton Gate, probably still thinking somehow you're back in Conakry, back in Guinea.
Absolutely. I trained on the Monday. I flew out on the Tuesday. I played on the Wednesday. I was back at Ashton Gate training. I trained on the Friday and played on the Saturday. So within a week, I'd gone from a red carpet to a hovercraft to being blessed by a witch doctor to playing a game to losing my luggage to paying $100, thinking I've stuck somewhere, to being back to where I started. And I just had a big grin on my face. It wasn't even about the 0-0. It wasn't about they made me pay for a visa or I lost my luggage. It was just an amazing to meet those people and to have had such a profound effect on people, but have no idea that you're having that effect on people is quite humbling in effect. And as an adult, then you realize your outreach. You know, you can, the effect you have on your family, you focus on the effect you have on your family and how you influence people around you. But sometimes you have an unbelievable influence on people who you'll never, ever meet. I was really fortunate to meet lots and lots of people who I had, and it was a positive influence as well. People, when I bumped into people I'd never met before, they smiled and they were really pleased to see me. And that was a really nice thing to experience.
Do you think the whole experience changed you as a person? I mean, you're known, obviously, you're very humble about it, but you're very good footballer, exceptional footballer. Yeah. And people like Stuart Robson, who played with you, will say that. But you're also known for the work you've done after football in helping people in race relations, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. We've talked about this, haven't we? The vague descriptions of all of this stuff. We talked about it a lot. But do you think you'd have got into that as much and been as good at it? I think that's the point. If you hadn't had that experience of the positive impact you can have as a person.
You're absolutely right. You know, it's funny, yeah, everything's kind of helped me to do other things. When you start broadcasting, it helps you to do, you know, when I managed the football club, that helped me to do broadcasting and vice versa. But when I start doing the anti-racism work and stuff like that, I'm very aware of who I'm trying to reach and how I'm going to reach them. When I broadcast, I'm very aware of, you know, because you're sat in a studio looking at a blank camera. But when you're able to visualize the people you're reaching, it makes your job a lot easier and you can connect with people. And I think that's what broadcasting is about. I think that's what any work you do, you need to connect with people. And when you're trying to connect with people all over the world, it's a lot easier having had that experience, realizing you are a role model. You are someone who, I was only a footballer, you know, it's not like I'm President Obama or anything, but in my own world, the influence I had just playing football and representing and being able, for people who are able to connect with me because my parents came from Sierra Leone, my heritage was from Sierra Leone, and the influence it had on their lives on a daily basis gives you an understanding of how to connect with people. And I think the biggest thing, the most important thing in life is connecting with people. You want to connect with your children. It's about connecting with your parents. But when you can connect with people you hardly know and have a positive influence on their lives, that's massive. And so I've taken that forward. So every time I do something, I always remember when I went back to Sierra Leone and played that game of football and the faces of those people when I first saw them, was this they'd known me for absolute years, you know, and that's a really important part of life.
If this was Piers Morgan's life stories, which it isn't, don't run out. Please don't run out. The obvious question, because you had the abuse that you took and unspeakable things that you went through, about a visit to Sierra Leone is that, Leroy, did you feel like you'd come home? That's the question, isn't it? But I guess there's an element of truth in that, isn't there? That suddenly you're amongst people who relate to you and who you can relate to, having gone through what you went through.
Absolutely. And I'll go back to when I first went back to Sierra Leone with my mum and dad, and you know, well, the first time I remember, I went younger, but when I was 11 and I went back to Sierra Leone and I looked around and I saw people who looked like me. And I know that sounds ridiculous, but when I was being brought up in South London, I didn't see many people who looked like me. And all of a sudden you're thinking, oh, right, that's why I'm like that. That's why I'm good at that. That's why I have all these traits. The second time I went back, I went back to people who wanted to embrace me. And that's not the, you know, I'm not saying that wasn't the case in this country, because when I played at West Ham, all the West Ham fans, but that's because I played for West Ham. These people wanted to embrace me because they saw me as one as them. And that is a very settling experience to have. Without you knowing it, you think, my God, people always say about coming home is the most important thing. And it was about coming home to me. And when my parents used to say back home, they used to say back home all the time. I couldn't relate to that. But as soon as I'd been there and I'd had that experience as an adult, I realised that that's what back home meant.
Did you grow up wanting to play for England?
Yeah, I played for England schoolboys. I had one cap for England under 21s. So the natural thing for me was to play for England, and the only reason I didn't play for Sierra Leone is because my dad would say, no, look, it's not, you know, it's not great, you know, you'll be upset after it. And I could understand, because when I went to manage Sierra Leone, I could understand about the way things were run, the way things were done. They were quite upsetting, but I took a lot of positives out of it, and that's something no one can ever take away from me. My one cap for Sierra Leone was an unbelievable experience, and I wouldn't change it for the world.
And talk to me about the management experience, because that's part of this match, really, because you wouldn't have gone on to do that if you hadn't played. It was a few years later, of course, when you were in management, but it was two games, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Was it I'm already seeing in your eyes it was chaotic, but what was it like?
Well, the we had a game here in England, and we played late annoying, and we played some terrific football. We won 5, and this is right. Myself and Paul Morton said, look, we've got to give this a go. Sierra Leone couldn't qualify for the Africa Cup of Nations, so we said, well, the plan was, we'll go and we'll take the team for 2 games. Because the players were from all over the world, we'd have a kind of a satellite training camp in around Paris where everybody could come and meet, and we could develop the national team. So that was the plan. So it was a good plan. When we got there, I took my son with me and my nephew as well to experience it. We got onto the training pitch on the national stadium, and not only were the 20 or so players there that we had in England, there was another 25 players there as well. So about 45 players on the pitch we had to sort out. And then so I looked at Paul and he looked at me and went, right, okay, let's get stuck into this. So we started sorting them out, the players we knew, the players we didn't know. And then as we turned around, I did a demonstration of what I wanted, a little bit of a transition play. And I looked around and there were thousands and thousands of people up in the stand watching this train. And you think, my God, this is unbelievable. And as the training session finished, walked off the pitch, people flooded onto the pitch, wanted to talk to you, wanted to touch you. And then we're like, again, it was like being in Take That, you know, for the whole week. We had players turning up just before the game who'd come from Vietnam saying, I've been asked to come over to play. And we go, oh, crikey. You know, there's all sorts of things going on. But the bottom line, we got to the game. We went into that dressing room on the day about an hour and a half before the game. There was about 100 people in there doing tickets and stuff. And Paul said, look, we can't do that. I said, Paul, just leave it. We are just assessing what needs to be done. Let it happen, and then we'll deal with it later. We managed then to get to the game through, I don't know how, but we got to the game. And we were playing Togo at home. We lost 1-0, but we had a real good game. It was a really close game, and we were coming off thinking, oh, wonder how it's going to go, because we had no experience of what went before. And everybody was delighted with the performance. They were really pleased, really proud, made us feel really proud. So we went back to the hotel, and then as we got off the coach, a man came up to me and said, oh, there's some really bad news. I said, well, what? He said, well, the Togo helicopter flying back to Lungi Airport had crashed. I said, you what? He said, yeah, it's crashed. It then transpired that the delegation had got on that helicopter and 30 people had died. And then the players were going to be on the next flight. So it was 3 days of mourning. So we experienced all of that. And so we stayed the extra 3 days, and we went back for the second game. When we got back for the second game, none of the players that we had for the first game had gone because they hadn't been paid their expenses. And this is what my dad was talking about, you know, African football. So we had all the local players. So we had to start from scratch again, and we were playing in Mali. Now, the other thing is, sometimes you're very naive, and people say, you know, how far is it to Mali? It only takes 6 hours to get to Mali. Oh, West Africa, no problem. So we trained for a week, and we sorted out the team as best as we could, and we got on we tried to get on the bus, and we couldn't, Paul and I, the coach and assistant coach, couldn't get on the team bus because the people on the bus refusing to get off. Because if you got on the bus, you got an allowance. So instead of getting them off the bus, we had to get a 4x4 to go behind the bus. So we travelled up, we got in front of the bus, and our 4x4 broke down. So we had to stop by the road, wave the bus down, then Paul and I squeezed onto the bus. He's got a bad back, I've got a bad knee. And this journey that was supposed to take 6 hours took 13 or 14 hours on a road that was full of craters and bumps and hollows. To Dakar, we had to get a flight from Dakar to Mali. We had to stay overnight. We didn't know. So we stayed overnight in Dakar. We got a car to the airport where the clutch kept on, you know, when the clutch goes and the engine revs up. So the guy kept on getting out the car, putting the clutch back in. And so this was all the way to the airport. And as we're getting close to the airport, the traffic is starting to really build. And we came to this roundabout and we could see the airport down this hill. And as he went across the roundabout, the clutch went. So the car went, and he was doing about 80, 90 miles an hour down this hill. And we were screaming, me, Paul, two people in the delegation. And we just came to a halt and we were holding on for dear life right at the back of the airport. And we said, look, thank you very much. We're going to get out now. So as we got out of the car, he said, right, he went to the back of the boot to get our luggage out, and he went to open the bonnet, and the lock came out in his hand, and he couldn't get in the boot. And so we stood by this car with our luggage in the back and for about 10 minutes, and then he had the light bulb moment, opened the back door, unscrewed the back seats, gave us our luggage, and we walked into the airport. And I looked at Paul, and I'm thinking, should we be going home now? And he said, no, we've got to see it out. So we flew to Mali. We got there. That night, there was a hurricane. Paul was on one side of the hotel. His window was blown out, so he spent the night in my room. The next day was the game. Fortunately, the night before, we thought nobody would give us our tickets home because I think the money had disappeared. So the night before, Paul and I had gone into the city centre and booked flights to France because that's the only tickets we could get. Anyway, the next day, we'd gone to the game. The game started. The referee's given the penalty in the first 10 minutes of the game. And me, stupidly, I've made rubbed my fingers together to the referee, and he's run over, set me off, sent me to the stands. This is after 15 minutes. So I've been sent to the stands under armed guard. So I've gone up to the stands. At halftime, I think we're 3-0 down. So I got up to go down, just go and talk to him at halftime. And the guy with the machine gun, who didn't speak English, just pointed at me, waved his finger and said, you're not going anywhere. And he had the machine gun pointing to me, so I wasn't going to argue with him. So I sat there. And as Paul came out for the second half, I could see him looking up in the stand, trying to find me. And then the game carried on. We lost 6-1. We drove away from there, went to the hotel, got our luggage, got a taxi, got to the hotel. And as we were just walking in the hotel, I said to Paul, were you looking for me, you know, at half time? He goes, yeah, yeah. He said, but I never looked for you in amongst 40,000 blackface. He said, I had no chance of finding you, and you don't realise that. We managed then to get back to France. We got a flight to City Airport. And then as we walked off that flight from City Airport, walking down the Purdy Road towards Paul's house, we just looked at each other and we just burst out laughing because it was the most, again, surreal experience we'd ever been through. And it was a wonderful experience, even though scary at times, but nothing could match that ever again.
Doesn't that whole story tell the two sides of African football? And that's the frustration I think many people have, because on the one hand, your cap as a player is the beauty and the joy and the passion and the reason that Africa can almost justifiably claim to be the home of football now, because the numbers and the passion and having nothing else and so on and so forth, what the game was for in the first place. And then on the other side, you see how badly managed it can be. I'm not saying it is everywhere, but it can be. And that's you're in almost a unique position, really, to judge that.
Absolutely. I mean, the second bit was about people who found themselves in a position where they felt they could get ahead. And if you look at it from those people's position, there was when we were training, there was a player from the local teams, and they all had a hotel room. And one of the managers said, could you go and just have a look at one of your players in one of his rooms? I said, all right. He said, please, just go and have a chat with him. So I knocked on the door, he opened the door, and there were 15 people asleep in his room. And I said, oh, what's happening? What's going on? He said, look, boss, we don't have anywhere to sleep. We never can never sleep in a place like this before. So I've got all my family, all my friends sleeping with me. I left them, because what can you say? You know, so these positions that people are in, you know, when we talk about the money for our flight tickets, well, obviously somebody giving them the money for our flight tickets, but it disappeared because, you know, you're looking, these were people who hadn't seen that sort of money, but in a position, what do they do if they've got, they've got a lot to eat, or, you know, and they've got money? Are they stealing money, or is it the situation that if you were in that situation, you would do the same? I don't know, but that's how I wanted to think of it, because these people were in really difficult situations. And that's why African football is where it is, because of the poverty, because of the lack of money, lack of opportunities. And people see this as an opportunity, whereas if they could get organised with the talent that they've got and the passion that they've got for the game, it would be amazing. But we have to overcome these hurdles of poverty to get to that situation. So I totally understand. It was a scary situation, especially had a machine gun pointing at me. But again, it was one that puts everything in perspective. I know people say that a lot. People say that a lot when their bad things happen. This wasn't a bad thing that happened. It was an experience, and it puts how lucky we are, you know, where we live, and, you know, the things we moan about are ridiculous compared to what these people go through.
Do you think we're guilty of judging African football, and indeed Africa, but from your experience, African football through Western eyes? Mm-hmm. In which case you see it very differently, don't you?
Absolutely. I think it's ridiculed. You know, African football for many, it's been ridiculed, you know, and I don't like that. As if, you know, the way we do it, and the, yeah, this is the right way to do it. Oh, they're African countries. You need a foreign coach because, you know, you don't know what you're doing. You know, it's backwards, basically. And there is that prejudice, I call it, which people carry around how they judge African football. And people need to, and I think Africans as well, need to be more proud and do it the African way. I think that's the key. And I think you know what, I think England have a problem with it as well with their national team. You're always looking to do it the Spanish way or the Portuguese way or the German way. Do it your own way. And I think African football needs to take a leaf out of that book and do it their way as well. And I do think there's now players who've got the experience and the knowledge who are top players, who will be top coaches, who can get through all the muddied waters, get the right people in place, people they can trust to do the job, be focused on seeing the bigger picture. And then when they get to that bigger picture, not only will everybody benefit from that, but the game would benefit from that in Africa. And I think there are people who were prepared to get into those positions. But you're absolutely right. European football ridicules African football a lot of the times, but some of the best players in the world have been African. And playing the game the African way is a real positive for me, because they love skill, they love creativity, they're passionate, they're strong, they're powerful, and clever, which is something that is left out, because always thought, oh, strong, powerful, yeah, creative, but are they intelligent enough? You know, do they need a European player to lead? I see lots of intelligent African players, like I see lots of intelligent English players, lots of athletic English players who aren't so intelligent. The same goes for African players. So it's the same for everybody. But I think that when people start to recognise that there are people within the African game who can lead, who can be focused, and put them in those positions of power, the only thing they can do is learn and get better.
And could that ever be you, that person? Would you like it to be you one day?
If someone came to ask me, would I like it to be you? Yeah, I'd love it. I'd love to take that responsibility. Because my role as a parent is to help my children to be confident in themselves and feel that they have an equal opportunity to everyone else. That's my role. I think it's my role as the person that I am, from the background that I've been into, to make sure I do that for everybody. Footballers are role models. My father's always told me that. Not only your role model to your children, but whatever you do, I've been in a position, having been to Africa and seeing the effect it has on people, and you've got to be aware of that. So yeah, one day if somebody said to me, would you like to help in implementing a system where we bring the best out of Africa? Yeah, I'd be up for that, because I know what the best of Africa is.
And just finally, Leroy, going back to the match, the one we spoke about, the match that this is about, you do realise if your sort of childhood dream of playing for England had come true, that would never have happened. Mm-hmm. Did that work out okay in the end, do you think?
Absolutely brilliantly. I played for England at schoolboy level. I played for England under 21 level. If I had played for England, I wouldn't have experienced the sun, the red carpet, the adulation, which I was not aware of. the love, and I wouldn't have this really warm feeling inside the pit of my stomach every time I think about it. So I'm delighted I didn't play for England at international level.
Leroy's now a pundit, a really good one, and works tirelessly with children to tell them that the colour of someone's skin is irrelevant, which of course makes him anything but. He once managed Torquay for 10 minutes, and he used to be more famous for that than anything. His book and the work he's doing still has already changed that. Next week on The Match, an episode that's simply called The Memory Man.
I'd love to have a conversation with that person, you know, a psychologist, and wonder how I have generated this story over the years, because I've told it a million and one times. I mean, John Moncur knows it. So now there's two of us that need to be on the couch. So we both know that story in our heads is true, but then you look at the statisticians in the YouTube videos, it's not true.
The Match is a Speechless Media production in association with IMG Media, and thanks to all of those involved in it for their support and considerable skill. They are Matt Vines, Steve Tebb and Ollie Neen, and all of the IMG team. And thanks too to Leroy Resenia for his time and patience. You can follow us on Twitter at The Match Podcast, and we'd really appreciate it if you could take the time to rate and review us on iTunes. It makes a big difference to what we can do and where we can go in the future.
To stop and mourn, I dreamed you'd gone. Woke and saw you and cradled your head, thought of a million things and more that I could say to you instead. We passed the time, dear, and I cradled your head. I like to keep things simple, I hate to get too solemn. If I say that people kill for what we got in common, would it be too ungrateful to say it's just not enough for us to remain? Last night.